This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. Welcome to Speak Up Kōrero Tia. Today we're discussing human rights and the Olympics. We're going to start with an interview with William Stedman, the youngest member of the New Zealand Paralympic team. And then after our break, we're going to be discussing the conversation further with former Olympian Barbara Kendall, New Zealand Olympic Committee representative Ashley Abbott, and researcher at Lincoln University, Rosalind Kerr. But for the moment, William, what does it mean to you to have been selected to compete at Rio 2016?
Real pleased. It's been a pretty amazing journey the last 4 years with training and just working really hard to get there. So it means a lot to be selected, yeah, definitely.
One of my questions actually was, how do you juggle all your commitments? I mean, you're still at school and obviously your training must take up a lot of time.
Yeah, definitely. Well, through the Pathway to Podium program, I had lots of help with athlete life and things to be able to use time management wisely and be able to manage your time well, which has been a big help in balancing both school and athlete life.
Did you say it's called
Pathway to Podium?
Podium?
Yeah.
Is it specifically for young athletes?
Yeah, it's a program run by HPSNZ, High Performance Sport New Zealand, for young athletes who have potential to get to the podium at big international events, yeah.
So how long have you been involved in this sort of pathway?
This is my second year on the program, so yeah, it's been really good. It includes strength and conditioning programs, nutrition, athlete life and mental skills support.
Actually, it's so interesting that you mentioned that mental side of it, because I imagine that's a large part of...
Oh, definitely. If you're not mentally right, you're not going to do very well.
Yeah, right. And what events are you going to be competing in?
I am competing in the long jump, 400 metres and 800 metres.
And I'm going to make sure that we stick that information up on our Facebook page so that people can keep an eye out for you.
Hi.
How are you feeling about it? Are you nervous, excited?
At the moment, I'm mostly excited, but just the big experience of going overseas to different countries and then to Rio for Paralympic Games. But I think definitely when the time gets close, I'll be very nervous.
You've competed, though, at this sort of international level before?
Yeah. Last year I competed at the IPC World Champs in Doha, Qatar. I competed in the 200 metres, 400 metres and long jump. I came 6th in the 400, 7th in the long jump and 10th in the 200.
Well, congratulations. That's really good.
Thank you.
Have you been to Brazil before, or are you looking for... What's the Brazilian aspect you're looking forward to?
I'm not sure what to expect, to be honest, because I haven't been to South America before.
And what are your aspirations for the Games?
At the moment, because I'm quite young, our main focus for these Games is experience, just to get maximum experience of what it's going to be like for future. I would, however, I definitely want to get into the final for a long jump, 400 and 800, and top six, hopefully, but anything can happen on race day.
And William, maybe you could explain for us, what does a week in your life or a week in the life of a Paralympian look like?
On Monday, I generally have a speed session with short sprints. Then Tuesday mornings, I have gym sessions that start at 6:45 and go to 8:15 at Apollo Centre behind Jelly Park. That afternoon, I usually have long jump training, focusing on my run-up or pop-ups. Wednesday, I then have either a gym session or another speed endurance session, which is like longer sprints to build endurance. Thursday morning, I then have another gym session at the Apollo Centre that starts at 6:45. And then in the afternoon, I have another speed endurance session, which is again to build endurance. Friday, I have a day off usually. And Saturday is either stairs work or uphill sprints to build strength. It's pretty busy and tiring, definitely. And then Sunday, I have a day off.
It sounds exhausting, actually, just listening to you list through them. Oh, goodness me. Very impressive.
Thanks.
Do you get time for, obviously you do go to school, but social events, other sorts of interests and hobbies as well?
Yeah, I've still got time for social events on the weekends and things like that, but I had to drop. I used to play cricket and soccer and canoe polo for a few years, but like since I've started doing athletics seriously, I've had to drop those to focus on athletics, yeah.
Did you say canoe polo?
Yeah.
What's that?
Oh, it's like, I guess, a mixture of like kind of like basketball, netball and canoes. Yeah.
Sounds fun. I might have to check that
one
out.
That's good.
And we were speaking about it before our interview, actually, the support that you'll get. You'll have, you know, some of the other athletes. Your family's going to be coming over.
Yep.
They did say, though, that they won't be able to kind of contact you. That might be a little strange, do you think? You know they're there, but...
Yeah, I guess so, but it definitely helps knowing lots of the athletes from the past, from going to World Champs last year and other competitions around New Zealand. So I think it shouldn't be too bad, yeah.
And what do you see your future looking like? Are you looking to continue in competitive sport?
Yeah, definitely. Next year we've got the World Champs in London, and after that World Champs again in 2019, and then on to the Tokyo Paralympic Games.
Oh, you're really looking far ahead.
Yeah, definitely.
And just the final question then. We're going to be following up this discussion with you and me with this idea of human rights in the Olympics. And if you hear that phrase, what does it mean to you?
To me, being a Paralympian, it brings to mind how like the Paralympics are a great movement of trying to challenge people's perspectives on people with disabilities and showing that they can do everything that normal able-bodied people can do as well. So that's the main thing that comes to mind.
Anything else you'd like to mention then?
Just thanks to my coach, George Edwards, and my club, Port Hills Athletics and Canterbury Athletics, I guess, being great support for me over the last 4 years, yeah, and my parents.
That's nice of you to say. I bet they're thrilled. Well, William, we really wish you the absolute best of luck for your events, and not only for your events, but just for the whole experience of being there and competing at such an absolutely high level. That's really amazing.
Thank you very much.
Best. You can be the King Kong banging on your chest. You can beat the world, you can beat the war. You can talk the guy, go banging on his door. You can throw your hands up, you can beat the clock, yeah. You can move a mountain, you can break rocks. You can be a master, don't wait for luck. Dedicate yourself and you can find yourself.
Standing in the Hall of Fame,
yeah.
And the world's gonna know your name.
You can run the mile. You can walk straight through hell with a smile.
You could be the hero, you could get the gold. Breaking all the records you thought never could be broke.
Yeah, do it for your people, do it for your pride. And you're never gonna know if you never even try.
Do it for your country, do it for your name.
Cause there's gonna be a day when you're
standing in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And the world's gonna know your name.
Politicians, be preachers, yeah. Be believers, be leaders, be astronauts, be champions, be truth seekers. Be students, be teachers, be politicians, be preachers,
preachers.
Be believers, be leaders, be astronauts, be champions.
Standing in the Hall of Fame,
yeah.
And the world's gonna know your name,
yeah.
Aki mai, welcome back to Speak Up Korerotia, here on Plains FM 96.9, hosted by Sally Carlton. That was William's choice of song you just heard, Hall of Fame by The Script. Very appropriate for today's topic of conversation, human rights in the Olympics. We've got three new guests with us now, Rosalind Kerr from Lincoln University, Barbara Kendall and Ashley Abbott. If you could all please introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about your background and why you're taking part in today's conversation.
So I'm Rosalind Kerr. I teach sport and recreation at Lincoln University, and specifically my research and background is in the sport of gymnastics, where of course there are quite a lot of human rights issues, but I also have expertise in general area around the Olympics, which is what I'm teaching at university at the moment.
Thanks, Rosalind.
I'm Ashley Abbott. I look after communications for the New Zealand Olympic Committee. And, you know, one thing I really value about the Olympic Games is the power of sport to inspire people and to do good.
And we're looking forward to getting into that a lot more, actually, the positives.
Barbara? Yeah, and I'm probably the last one. Yeah, I'm Barbara Kendall. I've been an International Olympic Committee member for about 12 years. And I've been representing sort of the athlete voice, women's voice, Oceania's voice and New Zealand's voice within the power makers of sport.
And you yourself were an Olympian, Barbara.
Yeah, so I was a five-time Olympian. I went to five Olympic Games, 92, 96, 2000, 2004 and 2008, and have won three Olympic medals.
I don't know too much about it, but it does seem that having been to five Olympics must be an incredibly long career for an elite sports person. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is. So I think there's only two other New Zealanders that have been to more than five Olympic Games, and one's Mark Todd, and he's about to go to his eighth Olympic Games, which is pretty amazing, and Ian Ferguson, who is a kayaker, who went to five Olympic Games as well.
Goodness, eight, that's amazing. Just to kickstart the conversation then, set the scene a wee bit, it might be nice to think about what are the Olympics, and particularly the differences between the Olympics, Paralympics and Special Olympics.
Okay, well, I can start off that. The Olympics, it's actually for able-bodied athletes. It's the Summer Olympics and Winter Olympics, and now we have a Youth Olympic Games. So the Summer Olympic Games has 10,500 athletes from 200 and I think we're up to 206 countries now. So it's actually bigger than the UN, because the UN only has about 170 member nations. The Summer Olympics goes for 2 weeks every 4 years. And then you have the Winter Olympics, and that is a lot less athletes, about 3,500 athletes from about 80 countries. And that happens every 4 years. So the next Olympics for that is in Pyeongchang in 2018. And then we have Summer Games, because we want to spread the love of what the Olympics and sports can do for many countries and nations and sports and development and all sorts of things. And so we have the Youth Olympic Games from the ages of 14 to 18-year-olds, and summer and winter, and it's more of a, during that Olympic Games, sort of like a festival where the kids do lots and lots of leadership education and life skills education and awareness of the environment and sport for all and what's happening in the world. So it's not just a sporting event, they do lots and lots of education involved in that. So, and then the Paralympics is for athletes that have a disability, and Special Olympics is for athletes that have a challenge mentally in those areas. So there's sort of three different areas. Now, the three organisations are quite separate from each other, although they do work collaboratively, and that's why the Paralympics is always held directly after the Olympic Games, to utilise the facilities, the volunteers, because it's already set up for a mega event, so it's nice and easy for the Paralympics to hold their events, whereas the Special Olympics hold their event at a different time.
And if I can just jump in, thank you, Barb. With the Olympic Games in particular, they're really a huge opportunity for the whole world to get together. And we see at the Olympic Games some 25,000 journalists from all around the world gather to share the stories of the Olympic athletes. In the opening ceremony, where all the different countries are there with their flags and national costumes, those ceremonies are watched by 4.5 billion people around the world.
Goodness, the numbers are huge, aren't they?
The numbers are really huge, and I, you know, when we think about the Olympic Games, you know, we would say the Rugby World Cup is really a significant event, and then if we put that on top of the Olympic Games, we're actually, there's 28 World Championships going on in one city at one time over a period of just 2.5 weeks. the numbers are really phenomenal, and that engagement of the population of the world is quite something.
And one thing that I think that I found really fascinating when we start talking about sport, it has the same set of rules no matter what country you're from, and there's nothing else in the world that has that equality. So, for instance, you know, the rules for playing badminton are the same in Pakistan as they are in Japan, as they are in New Zealand. Whereas you look at most things, like law is different in each country, religion is different in each country, culture is very different across countries. And with sport, can cut across all those things, and it's exactly the same right across the world, the rules and how you play the game and those sorts of things. Yes, some people get maybe access to different facilities and better facilities and maybe coaching and that, but the fundamental values and rules of sport are exactly the same right across.
And I'd also add as well that in terms of the competition between countries, it is a friendly competition. And, of course, it's a much more preferable way to bring people together through sport than through war, for example, quite obviously. And there's plenty of examples throughout history where sport has been used as that bridge between countries who aren't getting along so well. And so, as you say, that universalism that sport brings is really important.
Absolutely.
One thing I guess also to bring in here is the fact that the Olympic Charter actually mentions sport as a human right.
Yes, the Olympics is about putting that sport at the service of mankind, and it's a, you know, it's a lofty goal, but I think it's really important for all of us to take the chance to consider how we can use sport to do good.
Yep, and I think that's something that we'll be looking at later on in the show in more depth as well. Now, just in terms of the upcoming Olympics, Rio 2016, there are a couple of major issues that relate to human rights that we need to think about. One's the Zika virus and the decisions that athletes, particularly female athletes, are being asked to make, and also the doping and the banning of the Russian athletes. If you've got any comments to that, that would be great.
Yeah, well, I mean, Zika's an interesting one, isn't it? And we've been working really hard to make sure our athletes are absolutely informed about what the risks might be and help them make decisions, but you know, we're really setting out with providing them with things to minimise the risk, and the way to do that is by avoiding being bitten. So we're providing our athletes with insect repellents and mosquito nets and things like that. And then we know that it's winter in Rio, so the risk again comes down, and the city of Rio have taken significant steps. So you know, certainly we would be asking pregnant women to consider changing their travel to Rio, but otherwise we're expecting that the you know, mitigating factors around any risk really will make for a safe games for our athletes.
I think too, Zika really highlights the difficulty of planning a games when things are so extremely unpredictable. And I think sometimes there's criticism around, you know, choices of venues and so forth for games. But I think Zika highlights that you really can't predict in advance what's going to happen at any games. And it wouldn't have mattered where in the world this occurred. It just happens to have been in Rio, really. But it does create challenges. But I think it's been managed as best as it possibly can be under the circumstances. But, yeah, that unpredictability, I think, is something we need to remember when we are being critical about these kinds of issues.
And yes, just I guess it's our job on behalf of the athletes to get in there and do what we can to prepare ourselves and them for anything. But yes, Rossin, you're right, it can be unpredictable.
And I just, from an athlete's perspective, as a female athlete, you know, if this had been presented in front of me when I was competing, I'm saying, look, hey, I've dedicated 8 years of my life to get to this Olympic Games. Yes, the Zika virus is a risk, but I'd rather go to the Olympic Games because this is what I've aimed for, and then within a year's time, look at, you know, do the test to make sure that I'm Zika-free if I wanted to have children. And so, you know, it's just one of those different things that you have to think about. So I, as an athlete, your priority should be, actually, because you've dedicated so much of life, to carry on with the Olympic Games and go ahead with that.
And the reality, of course, with Zika is that women are being advised to avoid pregnancy whilst in the country affected by Zika and for 4 weeks afterwards. So, you know, it's a 4 to 8 week concern.
Okay, so relatively short term, I guess. And any comments on the Russian scandal?
For me, this one, it really brings me back to the German Democratic Republic issues that we had there. And of course, those court cases came through in the early 2000s. And I think it's a similar issue in the sense of who is to blame for any of the doping that now appears to be very systematic in Russia, and how much can you actually put any fault on the athletes who are part of the system, and how much blame do you attribute to officials who are making the decisions. But the difference, I think, from East Germany compared to Russia is it's difficult these days probably to say that an athlete is ignorant around doping processes, which back in the 60s and 70s probably would have been the case. So it is, again, a difficult one to work out where sort of the fault lies. But I gather that's what will be exactly trying to be established over the next time period.
Well, I mean, it was interesting to see the IAAF took a very firm approach to the situation, and they decided that whatever individual cases were, if they'd been training in Russia, then they wouldn't be heading to the Olympic Games. And, you know, it has been tough, and I know the Olympic world has been talking about balancing individual responsibility versus, collective. So, you know, you're right, Russell, it is in a very interesting situation.
Okay, well, we might have our first break. We've got Tub Thumping by Chumbawamba, another Olympics appropriate song.
Injected with a poison.
Welcome back to Speak Up, Kōrerotia. We've just said goodbye to Barbara Kendall, who's off to coach her swimming team, her polo team, I should say. So we've got Ashley and Roslyn with us. And we're going to start this next segment thinking about the various ways in which the Olympics do unfortunately provide the possibility for human rights abuses. One of these is the pressures that are put on athletes. And Roslyn, this is one of the things that you study, so you might be the good person to kick us off here.
Sure. Certainly in gymnastics, there are, of course, quite a lot of issues in this area owing to the young age of many of the competitors and the young age they begin training. And, of course, the other thing that's very desirable about gymnastics is it can result in a lot of medals per person. So certainly when you find an athlete with a lot of talent, there's significant pressure put upon them and so forth. And so some of the things we've seen in gymnastics, various kinds of abuse have become fairly normalised. Things like verbal abuse is pretty standard in the sport. And you, of course, also get the occasional physical and sexual abuse happening as well. And while on one hand these are somewhat addressed through organisations replacing coaches who are adopting these kinds of behaviours and so forth, it is very difficult to prevent them because often coaches have learnt these sorts of behaviours do result in success. So things like putting a lot of pressure on athletes to be very thin and they consequently develop quite serious eating disorders and so forth, that is of course not at all good for the athlete in themselves, but in terms of a medal winning strategy it can be quite effective. And it's often difficult with the pressure put on coaches and athletes to be successful to actually reverse that cycle. And of course our sports science research is constantly improving to find ways to do that. And so hopefully this is something that will reduce going forward. But I think too, with the age of some of the coaches who were trained in the 60s and 70s when those practices weren't so well understood, hopefully with time this will start to improve. Well, at least that's what I hope.
Yeah, well, I think those are, really important concerns to for our sports to be educated on. And I know high-performance sport had some... we're talking about this quite widely recently about, the care that needed to be taken, particularly with the early adolescent athletes. So, yes, absolutely, it's very important. And I think at the start of our conversation, Barbara talked about the Youth Olympic Games, and a huge focus of those games is on educating athletes and educating them about health and well-being and the importance of sports from a holistic level. And I think, that's something that's happening in the Olympic world. And if those lessons and the natural changes that are occurring that Roslyn mentioned can go down through sports, I think absolutely it would be something we would absolutely support.
I think New Zealand's actually doing a reasonably good job in this area. Certainly it seems New Zealand's got a very strong policy of holistic athlete development and really wants to move away from that sort of, hothouse attitude that led to a lot of these damaging behaviours. So I think in terms of our country in the world that's doing a good job, I think New Zealand can be reasonably proud of itself in this area.
It was actually one point that William Stedman made in the first part of this radio show, the various mental health trainings that they go through alongside the physical training. Thinking also about the possibility for human rights abuses, and these are ones that go beyond just the individual athlete but into the bigger frame of the games, thinking about things like the displacement of people from their homes to make way for stadiums being built. I know in Sydney there was a bit of an uproar because homeless people were moved off the streets while the tourists were in town. Allegations of poor working conditions around building the stadiums, these sorts of things, sort of state or corporation perpetrated human rights abuses.
That's right. Like going, if we look at an Olympic Games in particular, it's a huge amount of work and a huge amount of change goes on in the city to prepare for games. And what I'm really appreciating about seeing Rio is the focus has been delivering a positive legacy for the city. And I recall hearing that, a very small percentage of the population actually had access to decent public transport, and it was very difficult for people in outlying areas or in the poorer communities to get into town. And one thing they've really worked on with the Rio Olympic Games is to ensure that 70% of the city is connected by public transport. And that has been delivered, and I think that's really you know, a good side. But that's right, it does mean that there is a lot of upheaval and inconvenience in the city. And my understanding from Rio is that displacements have been very few and, you know, in the course of what would need to happen for any, you know, voting development in the city. But, you know, that's not to say there haven't been concerning cases in the past. And I think as the games move forward, it's important that those host cities delivering the games really do have a social conscience. And I think that's becoming more and more brought to the fore, and be very careful and proactive of looking at ways that the city can be improved and populations can be improved. And, you know, I do feel we are seeing that.
I would agree that definitely it seems to me that in looking forward, future plans for choosing game cities are very much based on their planning, you know, exactly their plans for the city as a whole, and rather than it just being purely for an Olympic bid, and that integration of the planning of the city with the Olympics, as opposed to them two not really being considered together, is a really strong move in this direction, I think. The other thing is, of course, with these issues, that them coming to light during the Olympics can be a kind of good thing in terms of awareness. That, you know, there are, as we've already spoken about, there's a huge audience watching the games. And sometimes it can be a really good thing to bring out these issues and start talking about them, discuss them, and try and find solutions.
I absolutely agree with that it's the Olympic Games does provide an enormous opportunity to shine a spotlight on issues, and it may not be the role or, you know, ability of an Olympic organisation per se to make a change, but it does highlight it and it gets talked about. And, you know, something we're doing with our Olympic athletes in Rio is, you know, we're identifying the, you know, the poorer communities in Rio, and we're just thinking about how can we create a connection and what little thing can we do to use the Olympics to actually do some good and to show our athletes that people from different parts of the world live in different environments and we can use sport to do good. So we've established a partnership with a community, or a favela as we would know it. So we'll be taking our athletes in and they'll be conducting coaching sessions and learning about their culture and different ways of life. And I think, you know, it's exactly as Wilson said, it's an opportunity actually to talk about some things that may not come our way or we may not feel irrelevant, and suddenly, you know, the Olympics are in town and we can actually see the good and bad and see if there is something that's not quite right, what can we do, small as it may be, to make a difference.
It's really cool to hear that you guys are going into the communities offering these sorts of supports. Fantastic.
Well, I think it's really huge, and we went to see them some months ago now and asked what did they need, and they said we need clothes and we need shoes and we'd love to get our boxing gym up and running again. And so we have been really pleased to be able to do exactly that we're providing a whole lot of clothes for them. We've donated all a gym full of boxing equipment and all number of different sporting equipment for the youth of this community to use. And you know, I think it's going to bring a little of the Olympic spirit to them, and also be a huge benefit for our athletes to realise the power of sport to do good, and to see that, you know, we're actually extremely privileged in New Zealand, and just to get a bit of an understanding of that.
One question for both of you is the Agenda 2020, which is the, I guess, the roadmap for the Olympic movement. This is the International Olympic Committee agenda. Which has kind of made some explicit comments on human rights in its recent release. Following the Sochi Games in 2014, there's now a ban on discrimination based on the grounds of sexual orientation. There's also a provision in there to force venues and infrastructure contractors to comply with international labour standards, and also to force host cities to guarantee freedom of expression throughout the Games.
I think those are all... Sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say these are all really positive human rights movement forward, actually, that we can see exactly what you've been talking about, the way the Olympics can spotlight.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's good because so the IOC implements something like Agenda 2020, and then as a National Olympic Committee ourselves, we then take those policies and implement them here. So, you know, we're able to make sure that we too are actually thinking about covering off discrimination based on sexual orientation, which is something that was relatively new. And so it just gives us all an opportunity to
look at what's happening, look at what could be better, and to. So I think Agenda 2020 is really highlighting some of the issues around sport and the ways that, you know, being proactive and being aware of your decisions and what you're doing can help change things overall.
I agree that I'm very impressed with the work that the IOC has done in this area. I'm also impressed by the specificity of it, because it's often quite easy to just criticise by saying, oh, they need to pay more attention to human rights. But really, sometimes it's hard to see, OK, what exact form does that actually take to pay attention to it? And by setting out, you know, very, very specific objectives in the way that they have, I think this is a really good way to go about it, both in terms of also integrated it into the bidding process so that cities are forced to confront these issues themselves even before they hit the media. I mean, we've just talked about, you know, that having the Olympics brings these things to light. But, hey, if they're coming to light even earlier during the bidding process, well, that's even better. So I think,
and it actually gives more time to make a change, doesn't it, when you are having to bid and you need to show that you're thinking of the well-being
exactly.
of your citizens as well as attracting athletes right from the beginning. And it's a, you know, it's a seven-year process from being selected as a host city to actually hosting the game. So before that, there's several years of thinking about your host bid. So you've almost got a decade where your city and country is influenced by the Olympic movement, and to have something as strongly worded and clear as Agenda 2020 means that your city has got a decade to make changes and make a contribution to making the world a better place.
Mm. Despite all those provisions we've been talking about, however, there has been some criticism of it not being quite explicit enough for some human rights organisations. They would have preferred it to be slightly more explicit in its human rights content. Any comments on that?
I think we have to remember that the IOC has a lot of different things that they need to consider. So it's fantastic that they have considered human rights in, as I said, quite a specific way, in the way that they have, and particularly targeted issues that have been big ones at recent Olympic Games. And at the same time, they still have a lot of other things they need to address as well. And so you can't expect an organisation to do absolutely everything. So I think they've done a good balance of dealing with human rights issues while also dealing with a lot of sports issues and commercialisation and ensuring the games are well funded and all those other things that are actually very important to ensure the games actually still exist.
Well, no, I was just going to agree with Roslyn that, you know, a single organisation can't be responsible for changing everything, and you know, all of the organisations around the world each play their part, and they're a jigsaw and they consult with each other. And I really commend the IOC for setting up formal relationships with, for example, the UN, and I think that's just hugely beneficial to see them working with the refugee programs as well. I just think it's absolutely the right thing to be doing, and they can't address everything in the world, but they're doing their bit. And I'm actually, one of the things I'm most looking forward to about the Rio Olympic Games is seeing the refugee team marching in under the Olympic rings and you know, just following their process through the games.
That's the thing I'm looking forward to the most as well, Ashley, actually. I think it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah. Mm. Well, of course, the New Zealand athletes as well. But it is, you know, a really special thing about the Olympic Games is that it is really broad, and it's a chance to actually have a look at the world as a whole and see, you know, what's going well and what's difficult, and to be able to take a group of people who are very, very disadvantaged at the moment with the refugee crisis and provide a little bit of hope for them, I think is wonderful.
Well, we're going to have our next song, Alma y Corazón. It's the official Rio 2016 song.
Eu sei o que eu quero pra vida, pois nada vem fácil, irmão. Sem o suor, o valor da conquista permanece em vão. Sempre é hora pra fazer algo melhor acontecer, e a sua hora vai chegar. Agora é pra valer.
Um mundo novo só de gente boa, esse é o meu lugar. Não nasci ontem, não, não. Sigo nessa missão, e assim eu vou chegar. Fazer acontecer, lutar e conquistar. Mantenho a fé pra caminhar, e assim eu vou. Oh, 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 oh. De alma e coração.
A vida não é brincadeira, não marco bobeira. Eu cheguei pra
acredito que tudo tem hora, tem o seu momento e tem o seu lugar. Pois errar faz parte, evoluir é arte. Basta acreditar, depende de você.
Um mundo novo só de gente boa, esse é o meu lugar. Não nasci ontem não, sigo nessa missão. E assim eu vou chegar. Fazer acontecer, lutar e conquistar. Mantenho a fé pra caminhar. E assim eu vou, oh, 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 oh. De alma e coração. Fazer acontecer, lutar e conquistar. Mantenho a fé pra caminhar. E assim eu vou, oh, oh, oh,
assim eu vou,
oh, 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 oh. De alma e coração.
Back to Speak Up Court Editor. We're with Rosalind Kerr and Ashley Abbott talking about human rights in the Olympics. And we thought just for this final segment we might think about, we've touched on it already, but expand on it. How can the Olympics be used to further or to improve human rights? One example, and Ashley, you might be a good person to talk to about this, is the idea of gender equality.
Oh, gender equality is something I have been working a lot in, actually, over the last year. It's something really important to our organisation, and I'm very proud to say that our CEO is leading in this space. She's a really, really driven and committed to supporting women through sport and through her work on boards and things. So a little project that I've been working on, and I say it is small because I think it's important to acknowledge that all of the things as individuals we do are maybe small, but they're all part of a bigger picture. So I've been looking at a project on how women are portrayed in the media, and we're looking at New Zealand, and we had a whole lot of research from 2006, and it really showed that women are actually treated in the sports media quite differently and are much more inclined to be portrayed as emotional, for example. They're much more likely to be put further back in the bulletins, all sorts of things. We saw actually there is an issue there, and I spoke at a conference in Qatar, a conference for female journalists from Africa and Asia, and it was very interesting to be with a group of women who came from very different backgrounds, and you know, really we were in a, as far as our gender balance issues, in a very privileged position. But you know, nonetheless there were issues, and out of that the IOC were able to fund a full research project for us. So we are looking at how the New Zealand sports media are covering our female athletes as we head towards Rio, and really how the team's panning out. I think for the first time ever we're going to have more women than men in the team, which I think is absolutely fabulous. We've got some hugely strong medal contenders from our female athletes. So it's incredibly exciting, and I am, you know, really looking forward to seeing how the research pans out, because, you know, by rights it should be about equal. But look, I do suspect that in spite of the work we've been doing and the efforts of, you know, organisations like NZME who've set up their She's Got Game website, I think there still may be a few differences in the style of reporting on men and women. But look, I think, you know, the Olympic movement has been able to fund us to provide a environment to speak and educate and share with other women from around the world. So on, you know, on a topic that's actually very important, and you know, that's sort of the tip of the iceberg in terms of how our female athletes can be role models for young girls coming through. I think, you know, in that area is absolutely huge what the Olympic movement can do for gender balance.
I'll be really interested in the real results of that study you mentioned, because certainly there's a long history of studies showing the way that women are athletes are so often portrayed as simply as wives and mothers and not in action shots and sexualized shots instead and all that kind of thing.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I'm very pleased to say that looking at all the research, the New Zealand athletes were much less likely to
yes.
be portrayed in kind of a glamorous inverted commas way, although
yeah.
we did see some quite surprising Australian examples.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't surprise me, because in terms of the coverage that, you know, the percentage-wise from men to women, internationally, women's sport only receives maybe up to about 10% of the coverage of
yeah,
sport.
And,
but
right.
in New Zealand, we're up, actually up more like about 15%, which I know doesn't sound high, but it's still much higher than other places, primarily due to netball. But it does show that New Zealand as a country has a higher culture of seeing, you know, sort of seeing women up there than a lot of other places.
Yes, I think that that's right. And I think in our Olympic sports, it is more balanced again.
Definitely.
But certainly, you know, even in the first few months of doing this research, it is true that the female athletes are more inclined to be portrayed using words like emotional or having an
yes.
emotional reaction, which, you know, may well in the end not be a bad thing, but I think it's actually important to look at it. And what's been neat is working with a group of New Zealand sports journalists on these things, and we're all finding that just by thinking about it, we're actually being able to make choices that lead us to more gender balance. And an example that we use at our work is to say, if we're writing on Facebook, for example, or a media release, if we would use a word that you can apply to both males and females, we will use that word. If that word cannot be applied to either gender, we won't. And you know, an example is, you know, a neutral example, looking gorgeous. You would never say that about a male athlete. So immediately the word gorgeous gets cut out of anything we're doing. And we'll, you know, say, don't they look fantastic, or what inspiring.
Or even athletic, or, you know.
Well, this particular example was, we were just looking at, you know, some athlete uniform that they were wearing some years
right.
ago, and it just was, you know, they did actually, they looked amazing, but it just, you can make an important choice with your words, and I think it's really important that we do, that we choose words that can be, that are gender neutral.
No, I agree, and that's fantastic to hear that that's happening.
Very cool.
Yes, it's our yeah. policy.
Yeah.
We've spoken a little bit about the refugee and stateless athletes, but if there's anything further to comment on that, that's something that's pretty dear to my heart. Any further comments on that? Is it the first time people have been able to compete?
It's not the first time that athletes have competed under the Olympic flag. And I remember for the London Olympic Games, there was an athlete from South Sudan who was competing in rowing. And at that stage, I'm not sure what the state of Sudan was in terms of United Nations, but certainly at that point, they didn't have an Olympic committee, so we're by rights, you know, a stateless athlete, a stateless individual in the Olympic environment. And so the IOC made dispensation for this athlete to compete under the Olympic flag. And, you know, that really struck me as an absolutely important and worthwhile thing to do. And so I have been following with interest the decision to go out into the refugee camps and work with the refugee organisations and identify, I think, initially a large group of athletes who, you know, were actually excelling at sport in spite of the conditions they were in, and they were invited to participate in different countries' performance programs, and eventually made their way through to Olympic selection. It's just wonderful, and those athletes, you know, at the very beginning of this program, we talked about the 4.5 billion people watching the opening ceremony. So those athletes will be in the ceremony in pride of place, and it will be one more thing that highlights the issues around refugees at the moment, but also bringing home that these are, you know, people that have got rights that need to be respected.
I think the biggest change this particular Games is simply the sheer size of how many there will be, and of course what's been going on globally that brings this to the forefront. However, there have always been a few, well not always, but I certainly remember back in Sydney, there's usually a few in every Games, where usually I would say they're greeted with a little bit of confusion when they walk into the Olympic Stadium. People are sort of like, what's the story with this? This year it will be a really big statement. Everyone will know exactly what the situation there is. So
yeah,
I think that's really the big difference this year, is the awareness of the issue globally, that, and of course the Olympics being such a big event will only remind us.
Actually, taking active steps to bring a team together at a much larger scale.
Definitely.
Ashley, you mentioned already what you're most looking forward to, which is seeing the New Zealand athletes and those stateless athletes. Rosalind, how about you?
Well, we mentioned earlier about Barbara's wonderful achievement and the number of games that she's attended. For me, in gymnastics this year, we have Oksana Chusovitina competing, and that will be her 7th Olympics at age 41, which is, wow. I mean, it's astonishing in any sport, but I think for gymnastics that has such a history of young girls competing, it's just really amazing to see a 41-year-old getting out there showing us that actually they can do top gymnastics. So that's a real highlight for me.
Fantastic.
That's amazing. One thing I'm really looking forward to is... you know, within our Olympic team, we put Māori culture has a very important place within our team environment. And, you know, I just love the feeling of, as our athletes march into the stadium, our beautiful kākahu, which is called Te Mahu Tonga, is worn by the athletes, and just knowing that so many people around the world can see that. And then also incorporating different elements of Māori culture into our team, which really gives our athletes a strong sense of who they are and what it means to be a New Zealander. It's just a real source of pride for me.
That seems like a great place to wind up. Kua pō te wā. We're out of time for today, unfortunately. Keep an eye on our Facebook page, all you listeners out there. Search for Speak Up Kōrerotia. To keep up to date with information about this show, we'll be putting up some of the information from the IOC and the New Zealand Olympic Committee as well. Also posting things about Williams events if we can find those. Thank you so much, Rosalind and Ashley, and Barbara and William as well, who are no longer with us on this show, for taking the time to share your expertise.
And thank you.
Thank you.